We're talking about Indigenous representation and music. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Let's take a listen.
I'm so indigenous, yeah, rocking indigenous strip from the rest of the hood I uplift. So proud to be native.
This song is called Indigenous by J25, a member of the Choctaw Nation. She frequently raps about her pride in her indigenous lineage and issues facing tribes throughout North America. What kinds of indigenous representation did you see growing up? What sorts of representation do you want to see? Have things changed over the years, or do we still have a long way to go? And, you know, which indigenous artists do you follow? Call in now, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Giselle Childs-Evans, better known as J25, is an Appleton-based indigenous hip-hop artist. She was recently inducted into the Recording Academy. That's the organization that presents the Grammy Awards. J25, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's an honor. Thank you so much for allowing me to join you guys.
Yeah, so let's start with the Recording Academy. You recently received a letter from that organization saying that you would be inducted as a member. How did you react when you got that news?
When I first got the news, I was excited and shocked at the same time. It definitely caught me off guard, but I was definitely very happy. You know, I feel like, you know, things are finally moving forward in my career, and it was just a blessing.
And what does it feel like to get that kind of recognition?
Oh, man, to get that type of recognition, it's definitely an honor, a high honor. I mean, that's something that you just don't get every day. And it just goes to show that, you know, hard work, when you work hard and you stay dedicated, it will all pay off.
And to you, what does it mean as a hip-hop artist, really to have the opportunity to influence, you know, who receives recognition in future music award shows like the Grammys?
It definitely gives me a chance to, you know, be a part of the change in the future of music. And also it gives me a chance to introduce a new sound, you know, in music, because that's important. You know, music and technology is changing every day. And, you know, with me being an indigenous artist, it gives me a voice, you know, for the Native American culture as well. So,
can you talk a little bit just about what the application process was like to join the Recording Academy?
Oh, yes, definitely. So, basically, to become a member, you have to fill out an application. And while filling out this application, you also have to receive two strong recommendations from pioneers in the music industry. It could be a producer or an A&R or something like, you know, something of that sort. Also, you have to have a consistent catalog of, you know, social media, like a strong social media presence, music, and, you know, your views on YouTube, they kind of got to be a little bit high, but you have to have a strong following. So that was pretty much the process, and what they do is they look over your, you know, your criteria to see if you meet the criteria, and they make the decision from there.
Now, the 64th Annual Grammy Awards in 2022 is going to be produced with an inclusion writer to ensure that it is more diverse and it's more representative of, you know, the population as a whole. How do you plan to use your influence for other music artists out there to receive recognition from the Grammys, which is still, you know, kind of the highest award that we still have for music right now?
Basically, I plan to see, the key is in this industry, and especially dealing, you know, being a part of the Grammy Awards, building relationships can help make lots of changes. Sometimes it's not even just about the type of music you make, but building those relationships and being a voice that can help change a lot of things. Attending the meetings. I also will be in attendance at the Grammys as well at the Staples Center in January 2022. So my goal is to, you know, build those relationships and continue to push diversity for all, you know, genres of music.
Well, let's stick with the genres of music, because the Grammys is not always the fastest to respond to a music industry that is, you know, evolving really quickly every day. How would you like to see categories expand to include more diverse artists and performers?
I definitely would like it to expand. Me personally, like, I would definitely love to see an indigenous category, because as I look at the category, as I look at the categories, you have rock, pop, hip hop, you know, jazz, blues, reggaeton even. But what I noticed is I saw no indigenous category. So basically that's what I'm pushing for, you know, right now. And I hope to see, you know, expansion in that category one day.
We're talking to J25. She's an Appleton-based indigenous hip-hop artist. She was recently inducted into the Recording Academy. That's the organization that presents the Grammy Awards. Now, J25, we often do not hear about indigenous artists and performers in mainstream music or even within the industry as a whole. You know, which music artists come to mind when you think about those with indigenous backgrounds?
One that I can definitely speak on would be an artist by the name of Tabu. He's a part of the group Black Eyed Peas, and he's an indigenous artist. A lot of people confuse him for being another, you know, ethnicity, but he is Native American. Surprisingly, a lot of people don't know this. Also, Beyonce Knowles is also an indigenous artist. I believe she represents the Choctaw Nation. And, you know, those two artists have had a very strong influence in my career. Another one I could name would be a guy by the name of Superman. He represents the Montana area. He has a very strong influence in the Native community. So those are like my top three that have really had a big influence on my music career.
Now, J25, let's take a listen to some of the music you have done, because you're a proud citizen of the Choctaw Nation, and you frequently sing and rap about, you know, Native American communities in your song Indigenous. But let's hear a little bit more of that.
Indigenous, strong and resilient, 500 years and we still here. We weathered the storm like trail of tears, going hard for my rest like I'm Ada Deer. The creator helped me see it clear, feathers up if you native and proud. Genocide still no wiping us out. I'm an eagle soaring high through the clouds, follow the leader.
Now, J25, these lyrics tell a story of historical events within the broader Native community, and also highlight community leaders. We just heard you call out Ada Deer there. Who are some of the leaders within the community that you are inspired by?
I'm definitely inspired by Bill Anatobi. He's actually our governor of our nation. Ada Deer, of course. What's another one? Cliff Matias. He's a big influence. Miss LaDuke. These are people who really are like our water protectors and who really push to do positive things within the community. Right now we have, you know, a situation with stopping Pipeline 3, I believe in the Minnesota area. And these pioneers, you know, they come and they march and they stand with the people and they protest. And, you know, those are the people that have a great, huge influence. And they inspire me to, you know, use my music to speak on these issues that go on in the Native American community.
We are talking to J25 right now. She's a hip-hop artist who raps about issues facing indigenous communities throughout the United States and North America, while also highlighting the culture and history of Native peoples. She was recently inducted into the Recording Academy. That's the organization that presents the Grammy Awards. And we're going to talk more about her influences in just a minute. And we're taking your calls and questions at 800-642-1234. I'm J. Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm J. Carlisle Larson. Artist J25 stays with us to talk about her music and her hopes for the 2022 Grammy Awards. She was recently inducted into the Recording Academy, which presents the Grammys. She frequently includes, you know, in her music, history about her indigenous culture and issues facing Native communities throughout North America. And what do you think about hip hop today? How do you think that the genre has changed? If you're indigenous, what do you think more people should pay attention to when it comes to Native people in Wisconsin and in other areas? Call in now, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, J25, we were just talking about the leaders that have influenced you and that inspire you as part of your music. And I also want to talk about some of the issues that have made it into your songs. I want to listen really quickly to your song, Land Back.
This for all of my cousins up on the reservations. Recognize when I'm speaking on, don't get televised. Missing murdered indigenous women. Genocide, losing all of our men and our children. Suicide, I'm pouring out my heart on these beats, trying to keep hope alive. Preach. I hope I'm not speaking too bold, but you need to know the truth, the real, the story untold. Teach. Since 1492, they tried to put
us on mute. J25, let's look at some of those lyrics. Let's listen to this, some of those lyrics, because, you know, there's been a lot of focus recently on boarding schools. There's always been a focus on missing and murdered indigenous women. Can you talk about why it's important for you to really remind us of this history?
Most definitely. I believe in this new generation. It's important, you know, to that our youth and that our kids are being taught the truth in school. I know for many years that they haven't been when it comes to history. Like, for instance, this is a very controversial subject. We were taught, even when I was in school, that Christopher Columbus discovered America. And when you really go back and you look at the facts, you know, Native Americans, my ancestors, were already here. So it's very important when we speak about American history that we are honest and truthful with our children in schools and making sure that they have, make sure that they're receiving the right information, you know, about the history, about the land acknowledgement, and not just from a negative standpoint, but also from a positive standpoint. You know, that's very important that we teach our kids the truth about Native American history.
And, you know, one of the things I've read about your music, since you, for much of your songs, you do rap about social issues, as we just heard. But can you talk a little bit about the uplifting, the cultural aspect that you really want to showcase in your music?
Oh, yes, definitely. Speaking on the uplifting, like, one of the things that I love to showcase is our annual powwows. And these powwows that we have are open to the public, very family-friendly. We showcase music, our traditions, the type of, you know, food that we eat. It's just a great environment that I encourage everyone to come out and eventually, you know, experience. I definitely, you know, love, you know, broadcasting that in my music as well, just to show people, hey, you know, get to know Native American culture, get to know our people and, you know, in our values and traditions and, you know, what we represent.
We're talking to J25. She's an Appleton-based indigenous hip-hop artist. She was recently inducted into the Recording Academy, the organization that presents the Grammys. And we're talking about her music, which showcases indigenous issues, but also talks about the rich cultural history of Native peoples throughout the country. Now, J25, one question I have is, you know, hip-hop is a pretty expansive genre. How do you see, you know, more indigenous performers like yourself making inroads in that pretty broad category?
I definitely see, you know, indigenous hip hop basically making its way into the indigenous music, making its way into the category because, for one, the public loves hearing a new sound. After a while, you know, they don't want to hear the same old music. So I believe that it will have a strong influence in music because it's something different. A lot of the artists are very unique, very dedicated to what they do. So it's only a matter of time before indigenous music as a whole will be like a household name.
Well, let's listen to one last song, J25. Here is Native America.
My native's still fighting for freedom. The government don't understand that. It's deeper than stimulus money. Stimulus money. Just give us our land back. You don't want to go to war with the tribes. All my natives on slide. You can't run from all those lies. Once you cross those enemy lines.
So J25, you're still talking about, you know, issues facing the community, especially with land rights, tribal rights, all of that. Do you see a parallel between the social justice issues of early hip hop and what you're rapping about today?
Most definitely. In a way, it's like it's definitely in the same category. The same struggles, you know, in hip hop and as well as the Native American community, you know, we have struggles with the pipeline, you know, and missing murdered indigenous women and not, you know, especially on the Indian reservations, not receiving the simple resources that, you know, our people need, like clean water. That's been a big struggle in the Navajo Nation. And it's just important to bring awareness, you know, somebody has to be a voice or we all have to be the voice and, you know, speak on our community so people can be aware and maybe, you know, and we might receive the resources that we need. So it's definitely, you know, when I look at hip hop and, you know, I look at what goes on in the Native American community, it's important that, you know, we continue to fight and stand strong together and bring awareness.
So J25, as we wrap up, what are you looking forward to doing next in your career?
Next in my career, I'm looking forward to, you know, taking my music and getting it on a bigger platform as to where I can distribute, you know, my music on a bigger scale. I would like to do more for the communities. as a whole for all cultures, you know, not just Native Americans. I want to help, you know, give back to the kids and, you know, people in need and pretty much, you know, that's what I want to do, just, you know, just continue to give back to the people in any way that I can. And I feel like that's what makes you truly a winner. It's not just about being successful or being wealthy. Wealth to me is making a difference in the community. And that's what I plan to do, you know, with my platform.
J25, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us today. This has been really great.
Thank you. It was an honor.
Giselle Childs-Evans, whose stage name is J25, is an Appleton-based Indigenous hip-hop artist. She was recently inducted into the Recording Academy that presents the Grammy Awards. I'm J. Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
There's a worn bungalow next to an empty lot and an otherwise crowded street here in Milwaukee's central city. This house, with its peeling gray paint, has been vacant for about a decade. Its windows are broken. The roof is completely shot. But on this hot August day, the house is bursting with activity. Reginald Reed says when his crew is finished with the rehab, a family will move in, paying on a rent-to-own basis. And they'll eventually own this house.
Every transaction doesn't require people to make money. And I think that's something that America probably needs to understand if we're going to really fix problems like homelessness and starvation.
It's The Morning Show. I'm J. Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. Imagine not having a down payment or credit needed to buy a house, but still able to get one. Across the country, experimental programs are becoming increasingly popular for would-be homeowners who can't qualify for a loan. Corrine Hess reports on Milwaukee Pioneer's effort to make this happen.
There's a worn bungalow next to an empty lot and an otherwise crowded street here in Milwaukee's central city. This house, with its peeling gray paint, has been vacant for about a decade. Its windows are broken. The roof is completely shot. But on this hot August day, the house is bursting with activity. Reginald Reed says when his crew is finished with the rehab, a family will move in, paying on a rent-to-own basis, and they'll eventually own this house.
Every transaction doesn't require people to make money. And I think that's something that America probably needs to understand if we're going to really fix problems like homelessness and starvation and all, you know, underserved communities having no opportunities.
All across the country, there are hundreds of thousands of people paying more in rent than they would for a mortgage. That's in part because they're low income or their credit score is keeping them from qualifying to buy a house. What Reed's program is doing is essentially cutting out the bank or mortgage company. After a 13-year career in contracting, he launched an employment agency that focuses on skilled trades. The agency's trainees renovate the homes, and they're given the chance to buy them, paying 60% of the market value of the house on a rent-to-own basis. Reed's working in a part of Milwaukee where incarceration rates are some of the highest in the nation. He grew up here.
This is the place where we technically don't make it. And so not only are we making it, we're thriving. We're creating opportunities for other people to make it, and we're doing it in a way where no one can stop us.
Reginald Reed works with the city of Milwaukee to buy blighted, city-owned homes that are affordable, but often require tens of thousands of dollars of repairs just to make them inhabitable. He has ambitious plans. He wants to build or rehab 11 homes on this block. Kirk Wagner is a master carpenter who worked on large construction projects in Milwaukee, including building Fiserv Forum, where the Milwaukee Bucks play. He now works with Reginald Reed to help train and oversee those learning the skills they need to rehab houses.
You got the satisfaction, you know, of knowing that you're doing something, not just filling my boss's pockets.
While this project is innovative, it's one of many rent-to-own rehab programs across the country. A California-based startup wants to help renters build credit until they can buy a place. The group is raising $165 million from investors that includes Jay-Z's Roc Nation and Will Smith's Dreamers VC. Logan Modishami studies the housing market at HousingWire, an industry trade publication. He says these innovative programs need significantly more investment, and cutting out banks or mortgage programs is tricky, in part because the U.S. government backs mortgage loans through programs like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
There's room to grow there because there's obviously a group of Americans that have just the kind of lower level income stream that just doesn't have the kind of buying power that other Americans have.
Reginald Reed says he plans to rehab or build 100 homes in Milwaukee Central City. And the waiting list of would-be homeowners is a long one. He and others across the country say they'll continue to work on ways to help people who can't get traditional home loans become homeowners. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now on the morning show, youth sports in this country are a $19 billion industry, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and our next guest has been investigating it for the past year. Tim Bannon started a year-long journalism project with the goal of examining concussions and other safety issues in youth athletics. But then the COVID-19 pandemic struck and raised a host of other pressing questions about the safety of prep sports. Bannon then spent a year following how schools, leagues, and athletes navigated the pandemic, and he's here to talk about it as another season prepares to get underway. Now, high school football kicked off its first games this past weekend, and we want to hear from you. Have you attended practices or games yet? How is your school playing sports amid the rise of the Delta variant? If you're a parent or a coach, we also want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Tim Bannon is a recent O'Brien Fellow in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University. He was previously a writer and editor at the Chicago Tribune. Tim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, JC.
So what are schools, families, and leagues as a whole grappling with as the COVID-19 pandemic continues? We have the Delta variant whose infections are rising, and we have another fall sports season. What's happening right now?
Yeah, I think it's somewhat reminiscent of what was happening last August, September. But back then, there were many more unknowns. People didn't really know how it was being transmitted. Of course, it was before the vaccine. And I think back then, a lot of schools decided not to proceed with even football. This year, it seems like most schools across the country and in Wisconsin as well have begun. And I think, though, they are being cautious to some degree. More, there are going to be fans in the stands. In many cases, the fans are going to be filling the stands. But I think what's interesting, I think, is that the WIAA, which oversees high school sports in Wisconsin, for instance, they've done a really nice job, from what I can tell, of looking at the science and consulting with experts and then trying to be very careful about how this all proceeds. So far, so good. But again, I think, as we know, this is a pretty wily virus and things can change. So I think people need to be cautious. And of course, the most important thing is, you know, getting vaccinated. What they found so far is that the schools where the kids aren't vaccinated, those are the ones where they've already had to cancel games.
So a lot has changed within a year. So last fall, adults and teens, we didn't have a vaccine. Tests are now way more readily available. How do you see that changing the dynamic this fall?
Yeah, so one distinction to make is that with pros, colleges, high school sports, those are all pretty well regulated and they're overseen by governing bodies. When you get into non-scholastic youth sports, which is this $19 billion industry, this is like club teams, travel teams, tournament teams. It includes things like Little League and recreational soccer, but the driving force there is the for-profit element of it. And those are not regulated. They kind of are, you know, they follow the guidelines of, say, the county or the city, perhaps, but they're really, their main drive is to make money. Sports are wonderful, but they're not as cautious as pros, colleges, and high schools. So there's two things. One, it's the ones that are overseen, and then it's the youth sports that are private. That's where I think you have to be careful to see how this is going to proceed. as we go into the rest of the fall. And then, of course, it's going to be indoor sports. And that's where we were last year. Is like, okay, once you're indoors, it's much more dangerous. And even in like Dane County, there's a mask mandate. So the question is, will volleyball players, basketball players be wearing masks? I don't know. I mean, 2 months is a long time in this pandemic. A lot can change.
We're talking about the start of prep sports with Tim Bannon. He recently completed a one-year journalism fellowship at Marquette University examining the safety of youth sports, pretty specifically within the COVID-19 pandemic, even though that wasn't what he went in to study specifically. So just a second ago, you were talking about the difference between pro sports, which are very regulated, and these private sports clubs, travel leagues, all that, that aren't. Now, how did, playing actually shake out for some of these clubs? Because being in a private team, maybe Little League, can be really expensive. Who got to play and who didn't get to play?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think something that the pandemic really magnified and exacerbated was the haves and the have-nots. So if you go back to, say, last May or June of 2020, pros, colleges, high schools had all stopped playing, completely suspended operations. But the one sport that was forging ahead across the country, except with exception of some states, was youth sports. And they were holding tournaments. And even in states like, let's say, Illinois and Minnesota, where there was no youth sports allowed, teams were coming to Wisconsin to play in tournaments in the Dells and in Pleasant Prairie and other places where, they were still allowed. So that was one difference. But what also is happening, I think, is because it's so expensive, you also have a lot of kids who just can't afford it. I mean, it literally can cost $8,000-$10,000 a year if you're on a club travel team for all the expenses they have. And, and meanwhile, Park District, other leagues are losing membership and or they're suspended operations. So now you have the wealthier kids who can play and those who don't have as many resources or time. It isn't always money. It's also time to do it. And studies have shown that there's increases among the higher income and decreases among the lower income. And one point to make is you go, oh, well, it's sports. Does it really matter if a kid plays basketball or volleyball or baseball? Yes, it does. And I think studies have shown that it, increases self-esteem. It reduces depression. It increases their ability to succeed academically. So it does matter. And I think that's the concern, is this divide going to grow? And it's yet to be seen.
We are talking about the business of youth sports and COVID-19. Our guest is journalist Tim Bannon. I'm J. Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm J. Carlisle Larson. Our guest right now is journalist Tim Bannon. He's been following how the youth sports industry responded to the COVID-19 pandemic and how it's preparing for autumn with the rise of the Delta variant of the virus. Now, parents or students, how is your school handling sports during the coronavirus pandemic? Are students being allowed to compete? And are you feeling better about the safety of some sports more than others? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Now, Tim, over the course of the pandemic, what did you learn about the role of youth sports in spreading the coronavirus?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think so first of all, what we did was when we saw that youth sports was forging ahead, we went out, we sent out reporters all across the Midwest to see how they were handling pandemic protocols. And we found that there was a real checkerboard of regulations, also, varying degrees of adherence by the fans, and then also the enforcement was quite lax. But we did find that they were, they were going ahead with youth sports. And I think that it's clearly that that's where they were headed. We did find that, yes, they were had a plan and they were continuing to do it. And I think for the most part, they, with some exceptions, they did quite well. I think it also, it became very politicized as well. You had, you know, some states that developed these let them play initiatives by parents who were very upset that their kids could not play football or basketball. What struck me was that you didn't really see any, you know, let them play the trumpet, let them play in the chess team. It was sports parents who I think were really the ones behind this. And that's one of the key elements here, is that between sports parents and then the for-profit industry, that's where I think you have to be careful. Because I think what you have to ask yourself, why are you doing this? What are the reasons for it? So I think, you know, you just got to pump the brakes sometimes and make sure you're doing this for the benefit of the kids.
Now, I know that you interviewed parents of some of these athletes. Did you gain any insight as to why they were really beating the drum to keep athletics going?
Yeah, I think, again, it's you know, it's very similar to the vaccine debate. You know, some didn't really even think that the virus was a real thing. Others, you know, I met a woman outside this huge sports complex in Indiana, which had 30 baseball fields, 25 soccer fields, a huge basketball arena. And she was waiting to bring her kid into this basketball center. This is in August. This is right, you know, when things were really rough of 2020. And she was, you know, you could tell she was terrified by all these people inside, many not wearing masks, but it meant so much to her kid, and her kid really wanted to play. She had very mixed emotions. And I think a lot of parents struggle with this decision, you know, and I think that's one of the keys that I think when parents get involved in sports, they have to talk to people, talk to the coaches, talk to other parents, and talk to their kids and make sure that everyone is doing the right thing and everyone is comfortable with how this is being handled.
We are talking about the start of prep sports with Tim Bannon. He recently completed a one-year journalism fellowship at Marquette University examining the safety of youth sports. Now, what steps could schools, leagues, athletes, or fans take to improve safety amid the pandemic?
Well, I think many have, and I think I got to, again, give credit to the WIAA, who's done, I think, a really good job. They required masks during the indoor season. They have protocols in the outdoor season for how often kids can practice and where they can practice. So I think at the high school level and then college and pros, I think they know what they're doing. Again, when you get down to the lower levels, and again, one of the keys here is that it isn't so much what's happening on the field. It's not as if kids are transmitting it necessarily to them, each other, while they're playing football or soccer. It's what's happening off the field, on the sidelines, in the dugouts. It's happening when they're coming back and forth to the games and the buses. It's also when parents are traveling around to these tournaments, they're congregating at the hotels, they're all getting together. That's the concern. That's the concern. That's the community spread. It isn't on the field necessarily. It's everything around it. And I think that's where I think, again, the regulations become less visible. And that's where, with the Delta variant, transmission becomes a concern.
So, Tim, we mentioned that when you started this fellowship, your goal was really to look at other safety concerns in youth sports like concussions, but the COVID-19 pandemic obviously sidelined that. Can you talk about some of the pressing safety concerns that we're seeing in youth sports today?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, when we pitched this idea, which was way back in February of 2020, that was our intent, to look at injuries, you know, ACL injuries, ankle injuries, concussions. And then, you know, within 2 months, we realized that the predominant health and safety issue was COVID-19. But now, and we finished up the series with a look at this injury issue, which, you know, is resurfacing. So you have, first of all, you have the highest level of participation ever in this country for youth sports. 5 million kids, many, many million kids, youth kids playing high school and college playing sports, huge numbers. But the numbers of injuries that are occurring are increasing dramatically. For instance, there was 148% increase in ACL injuries and surgeries over the last 10 years, which is just extraordinary. I think what's happening is that kids are really overusing them, overexerting themselves. And also there's this issue of specialization, which is driving, I think, a lot of these injuries. And they tend to be lower extremity injuries, knee, hip, ankle. And one of the problems is that they're only playing one sport, and there's great pressure to do that, especially, again, in this private youth travel tournament teams. And so the pressure from the coaches and their teammates is to play with these teams 12 months a year, and it's just not healthy. They need to develop other muscles. They need to play other sports. And there was a University of Wisconsin study that showed that kids who play, who specialize in sports, have a 70% greater chance of sustaining those injuries. And even, and everyone thinks, well, if my kid doesn't play basketball or football all year long, then he's never going to make it into college or the pros. And there was also a study that showed that 95% of all the draftees in the NFL over the last 10 years were multiple sports athletes. So not only does it prevent injuries, I think it makes you a better athlete. So I think you have to resist the pressure from coaches who want these kids to keep coming to practice, paying the fees year round, and try something else. You know, maybe it's not another sport, maybe it's another activity, but give your body a rest. And I think as this divide increases and the rich and the wealthy can continue to do this, those for-profit sports are going to drive it. And that may be a real issue down the road. And I think it's already a problem and it could get worse.
So, Tim, as we begin to wrap up, we are heading into this new season. We have the Delta variant on the rise. I know that there are, you know, people can get vaccinated. Not everyone is. People can wear masks. Not everyone is. What will you be watching for in terms of, you know, spread at these games and really safety across the board for these students, parents, and coaches?
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm most interested in seeing is how the return of fans is going to change things. I think you had empty stands everywhere pretty much last year. In fact, even if you watch the Little League World Series on ESPN now, there's almost no one in the stands. They're being very cautious. But, you know, across Wisconsin, Friday Night Football, fans are filling the stands. So I think that's where I think that's the pressure point, is to see how what happens there. Is there more community spread, especially again in those communities? And Wisconsin has counties that have very low vaccination rates. What's going to happen in those counties after these big games where it's attended by a lot of fans? Is there going to be more community spread? I think among the players, it'd be interesting to see how, you know, the schools react to having to cancel games, how they institute these protocols. But I think really the concern, and I think it's been proven, again, it isn't so much what's happening, you know, between the lines, it's what's happening on the sidelines and the stands and to and from the game. So that's where I think everybody's got to be careful.
Tim, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Tim Bannon is a recent O'Brien Fellow in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University, which is also a sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. He investigated the safety of for-profit youth sports, including their response amid the pandemic. Just ahead, another installment of our Ask a Contractor series. We answer your questions about roofing and installing solar panels. That's coming up. You can join in on The Morning Show. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. This is the Ideas Network.